Welcome to another edition of Subversity. This is Ben Zhang, the host. Today we're going to talk to a former UCI graduate student who graduated here with a PhD in physics. And he was a peace activist at the time. And he'll talk about his education here and what happens to professionals in the workplace. He's the author of a book called Disciplined Minds. And with us in the studio to talk with him is adjunct assistant professor Stefano Sensi of Neurology Department here, and also Mike Tuados, a graduate student right now in physics. So welcome to the show, Jeff Schmidt.
Thank you.
Yeah, why did you write this book called Disciplined Minds?
Well, I actually got the idea while I was a graduate student at UCI. I saw the best of my fellow graduate students dropping out of the graduate program or being kicked out, and then I wondered why that was. I started looking around, and I saw that in all the fields, not just physics, overall there's about a 50% dropout or kickout rate from graduate school, and the process is not politically neutral. It seemed to me that the most broad-minded students were the ones who were most likely to be kicked out or to flunk out, whereas the ones who were more narrowly focused were better set for what the faculty was looking for.
So if they play by the rules, they were allowed to graduate.
Exactly. What it came down to was that those who actually tried to figure out, who spent time deliberately looking at what the rules were so that they could outdo the others in obeying them, outdo them in obedience and conformity, those were the ones who seemed to be favored.
So was this in the 70s when this was happening?
Mid-70s to 1980.
And you mentioned some notables in your department. people that won Nobel Prize now and they write science fiction?
There were some, I think the science fiction writer, Gregory Benford, is still a professor in the department.
They named the building after the other guy.
Yes, Frederick Reines. He signed my dissertation.
But he also fired. Did he fire you or what?
Yes, he fired me too. these people who Reines is honored now, but at the time I was there, he was not really all that respected by the faculty for his physics work. He was quite respected and powerful within the department for his grantsmanship. He was part of the Los Alamos Old Boys Network. He had worked on the hydrogen bomb at Los Alamos.
And when the director of Los Alamos came, you questioned him, right, at a physics forum?
That's right. They invited the director of Los Alamos to give the weekly physics seminar, and it was a big deal to have this big laboratory director there, but I and some others in the Science for the People organization questioned him about his promotion of the neutron bomb. I don't know if you remember the neutron bomb, but the idea there was to build a bomb that would kill people but not damage any property. Buildings or other property.
Exactly.
And he had
very important.
And this director of Los Alamos, who was a friend of Frederick Reines, he had promoted this neutron bomb by sending a team to Washington, D.C. to lobby for it.
That's the opposite of collateral damage.
Yes, exactly.
But how about what happened with you in the department involving, you have some critique of the senior faculty in your department over the fact that they depend on grants and on state determination of what research they would do, huh?
Yes, that's the way I would see it. If you ask them, though, they would insist, and they would go out of their way to find ways to tell you that they are not at all directed by anybody but themselves. They maintain the image of being self-directed. However, if you look at the way the funding system works, you see that physicists adjust their interests according to where the money is. If there's big funding in a particular area, they start getting interested in that area, and they start submitting research grant applications in that area. And when they get the grant, it appears as if they're being funded for research that they propose, which is true, but they propose areas that are going to bring in the money. Frederick Reines was very good at bringing in the money. That's how I ended up on his payroll.
But how come you were criticizing some of these people, but then, you know, Fred Reines is able to write science fiction. Isn't that a...
That was a different...
Benford, sorry. Benford. But him to write science fiction. Isn't that like an extracurricular activity that... The school didn't mind that, huh?
And that's right. The school didn't mind that. And they didn't question Benford as to whether he did any of his thinking about science fiction in his office or not. This is when I went to Physics Today magazine after graduating from UC Irvine. When they saw the book that I had written, they raised this question and then fired me.
Raised what question?
The question of whether I had worked on the book in my office.
But you admitted that in your book.
Yes, I say in the book that I did some work on the book in my office.
It's a stolen book, you said.
I begin the book with a takeoff on Abbie Hoffman. You know, Abbie Hoffman wrote a book called
Steal This Book.
So I start off my book by saying, this book is stolen. And then I go on to explain that I did some work on the book in my office. Now, I should explain a little bit. Physics Today magazine, which is published by the American Institute of Physics, maintained a somewhat academic workplace culture. They allowed employees to do whatever they wanted in their spare time as long as they got their work done. And I always got my work done ahead of deadline. So while my coworkers were playing computer solitaire or surfing the web or making personal phone calls or whatever, I was working on a critical book about work. disciplined minds argues that management's paramount concern is always the political content of the work. What I learned by writing the book is that they also judge what you do in your spare time by its political content. Because a few days after they saw the book, a group of managers came for me and escorted me out of the building like a criminal after 19 years on the job.
They change your locks.
Well, they had electronic locks, and they electronically canceled my access to the building and told me never to come back.
Jeff, hi, this is Stefano.
How are you? Stefano, great to talk to you.
Thanks. First of all, congratulations for your book, which is really very, very good. And I recommend it to all the students that are working here at UCI and doing activism. It's actually a very important book.
Thank you.
I want to address a few points specifically about the book. And one of the key points is actually the distinction between professional and non-professional workers.
Yes.
And who are the professionals?
What is my definition?
Yes, exactly.
Well, my definition is a little different from the one that the Census Bureau and the Bureau of Labor Statistics uses, yet it comes out naming pretty much the same people as professionals. They define professionals by education, how much formal education people have had, whereas I have noticed a political element to the work. In other words, the product of professional labor takes sides, like the journalist's angle on a story, or the accountant's bookkeeping decision, the lawyer's choice of contract language, the historian's depiction of events, the minister's sermon, the teacher's lesson, the welfare worker's findings, even the speechwriter's joke. Professional work tilts one way or the other, and the way it tilts is never an accident. And professionals are the people who employers hire to incorporate a certain point of view into creative work.
Exactly. Actually, there are key points in your book that I like a lot. First of all, you destroy several myths about, you know, professionals and the perception that we have of well-educated people. I think one at the very beginning of the book, you address the myth of liberal professionals and how much are not actually really liberals when it comes down to doing something that has an impact on his own, on their own life.
Exactly.
I remember the that nice example about the jury that they select in Pennsylvania, and how the blue collar jury was way more progressive in reality than that.
Yes, indeed, the professionals are liberal on issues that are far away, but when it comes to the decisions they make in their own work on a day-to-day basis, they're very conservative, and they end up making the decisions that their employers would have made had they been doing the work.
And they have a great tendency to conform. You also mentioned the story about the National Association of Black Journalists and the way they handled the Mumia case, which is pretty ridiculous. You want to tell about the story?
Yes, the National Association of Black Journalists, which Mumia Abu Jamal was a member. In fact, he was the head of the Philadelphia chapter of that organization. They were pretty much alone among various organizations in not supporting Mumia. They said, well, this is a political issue, not a journalism issue. And they felt that if they took a position on that they would be discredited within the profession. In other words, that the big corporate media employers would look at the black journalists as being partisan rather than objective. So it was an unfortunate situation. When the black community heard about this and was outraged, the National Association of Black Journalists quickly changed its position. And what they did, they took a very strong position on Mumia's right of free speech. They said that Mumia's right of free speech had been restricted on death row, and that this was an outrage. But they never did complain that killing him would be wrong.
In the American society, I think that there is a strong emphasis on education, and I think one very well written point is about this other myth of actually unrestricted access to education. You actually start your chapter describing this this little thief that is playing the three cards game, and it's pretty much the same stuff that you know, academic institutions do. They leave you with the expectation that you can actually go and do whatever you want, but in reality there is a pretty strict control in terms of who is going to get in. In fact, I guess you mentioned that there is one position for medical doctors, there is one position out of 17,000 citizens.
Yes, that's right. Three-card Monte is a hustle that I saw played on the streets of New York City. There is a good analogy between that hustle and the American educational system, which promises people a lot, promises infinite mobility, but doesn't deliver on that. The thing about three-card Monte is the role of the shills. There are shills in that game who, when the mark or the victim loses, the shills will say, "Oh, too bad," as if this were a matter of luck or fate or some failure by the victim, when actually the game is rigged against the victim. And in education, these so-called objective tests, like the Scholastic Aptitude Test or the Graduate Record Examination or the PhD qualifying exams, they play a similar role. They appear to be objective technical exams, but when you examine them closely, like I do in this book, you see that they do test for a particular attitude. They test for values and attitude, and the attitude they favor is a subordinate attitude, a willingness. They select the people who are willing and able to have the politics of their work assigned to them.
You talk also about the testing and extensively, and I found it very, very true that most of these days people are actually tested in a very aseptic way, although these tests are quite biased regarding gender, class, and other issues. And it's actually very intriguing, the example that you make about the qualifying exam for the PhD students, in which actually they are forced, and we actually have a survivor, someone that actually just passed the test, so we can share some. You actually tell very, very clear that people are not encouraged to use their brain, basically. They are not, they are actually pushed to learn the right answers and actually to pass the test by memorizing the most, the highest number of right answers instead of actually practicing creative problem solving. Is that right?
That's right. The people who stop to think about a question rather than recall some kind of answer from memory do not do well on the test. They fall behind. These students study for the PhD qualifying exams by studying old tests. The physics department, for example, makes available to the students tests from previous years, and the studying consists of going over those old exams and memorizing them, because the questions repeat in various disguises. Now, one of my fellow graduate students at UC Irvine refused to study old tests. He studied just as hard as everyone else, but he studied physics books and pursued his interests. And he did pretty well on the test, but they flunked him. He couldn't do well enough through that technique of studying. He passed.
I'm really curious to know if actually Michael can say something about the testing process. And you have mentioned that actually the score of the test is not a critical factor, right? You can actually pass the qualifying exam even if you score your score is actually low. There are many other factors. I would like to know what is the story now.
Yeah, essentially I would agree with Jeff. I think it's the same as it was when he was in school. It's basically a test more to follow directions than to actually think critically and ask new questions about physics. Would you agree with that, Jeff?
Definitely, yes. You just took the test a couple of months ago?
Yeah, right, last spring. I passed it, luckily.
All right.
But you described graduate school almost as a military boot camp, basically. They have pretty much the same principle. Actually, you went on with the 10 principle that people use in the prisoner camps to brainwash prisoners. Is that still accurate?
Yes. I when I interviewed graduate students, what they were telling me reminded me a lot of what I had heard about these organizations that engage in so-called brainwashing, these cults.
Right.
And looking into it further, I found that there are 8 themes that cults use. For example, controlling the milieu. They isolate the inductee from the rest of society so that the people can't tell how their values are changing. And the same thing happens in graduate school. With the overwhelming amount of work, people rarely even have time to read the newspaper. They lose contact with their families and friends, and they're pretty much isolated.
Would you suggest, Jeff, that there's any way around that in graduate school?
Definitely. In the book, I summarize the prescription in one word, which is organized. In fact,
right.
After I saw that graduate school had these parallels to brainwashing, I thought to myself, well, why don't I track down a brainwashing resistance manual and see if that's going to be of any use? And I found one. I found that the Army had issued a manual for prisoners of war. In case their troops are taken prisoner of war, this manual teaches them how to resist brainwashing.
And it says in this manual to organize.
Right.
Yeah, that's the main theme of the manual, is for the prisoners of war to organize. And that way they can engage in what the military calls honorable survival. Survival isn't an issue in the prisoner of war camp, actually. The question is who you will be when you get out of the camp. And they call that honorable survival, and organizing is the key to it. So in Disciplined Minds, I joke that the United States Army issued a survival manual for graduate school.
We're talking with Jeff Schmidt, who's the author of Disciplined Minds. The number here is 824-5824, if you want to chat with our guest. This is Subversity here on KUCI. And opinions expressed on the show are not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. You talked about organizing, and when you were at UCI, you organized this Science for Peace group.
Science for the People.
For the People group, right, I remember. Yeah, the group. And you mentioned a case in which one of the people in the group had actually died of cerebral hemorrhage, Scott Nakamura. And
that's right. He was working in Frederick Reines' laboratory, and he fell over and died. And some of us asked that Scott's PhD be granted just for his family's just to make his family happy, because they were very proud of Scott.
You know, they've
and,
done that.
Frederick Reines refused.
They've done that actually recently with undergrads. I had a student who died, and they gave her her BA, a Vietnamese student recently. So I think things have changed, maybe. I don't know. This was undergrad.
Well, there is a tradition of posthumous degrees. That's not unusual.
Right.
Scott had been a graduate student for many years, so he certainly deserved the PhD. But Frederick Reines said, no, the PhD is the coin of the realm, and we cannot devalue it by giving it to someone who didn't complete the program.
So what did they finally give him?
Well, we got a petition going, and we forced the department to form a committee and hold hearings on the question. And but they named Ryan as the chairman of the investigating committee, which he didn't want the committee to exist in the first place. But he was the chairman of it, and they finally agreed. They came to a compromise and gave Scott a C-Phil. It's called. Candidate in Philosophy degree, which is somewhere between a master's and a PhD.
Right. And then you also mentioned in the book that when you applied for the job at Physics Today, professors here told them what your politics were.
Well, one professor, Gregory Benford, had a phone conversation with my boss at Physics Today and told her what he knew about my political views. And she noted, she wrote those down and put them into my personnel file. Fortunately, by the time that happened, I had already passed the probationary period at Physics Today. They didn't take any action against me at that time.
They thought you were a revolutionary.
Well, that's what Benford told them. And there was, of course, some truth to that, but it was not something I had announced to my employers, of course.
Was there FBI surveillance then of graduate students, do you know, at the time?
There was probably not FBI surveillance except of activists.
Yeah, because I wrote once a few years before that, when actually the first year of UCI, the U.S. Navy actually kept track of UCI students who were in the first year and were in the SDS, and they had protested at the base. In El Toro, and they kept track of all the students' cars and who was speaking. They had even transcripts of the speeches there at the time in 65, 66. It was, of course, during the Vietnam War.
Right. I'm not surprised. Activists are a threat.
So are you still an activist?
Yes, I am. I am. Mm-hmm. In the book, I argue that if you're not an activist as a graduate student, you're not going to be one after you graduate, because graduate school really is preparation for what follows. And
so is the solution to organize as a union, like for TAs and stuff?
Well, that's part of it. It's not necessary to have a union. There are all kinds of ways of organizing. A union is a great way to do it, if you can do it.
Actually, there is another aspect that I really like a lot about your book is actually the strong reference to class bias. And you mentioned that basically, I don't know if it's still true, but definitely the school didn't encourage any part-time work during the graduate program. Basically,
well,
they don't want anyone that is not dedicated completely.
You have to work on campus, you're saying.
I think the policy still holds today. This was written right in the UCI catalog. It said graduate school is expected to be a full-time activity. Anything else has to be approved by, has to get special permission of the school. And when you look into that, you see that it is not because they don't want the students to be taking time to work on jobs, because they offer students jobs right on campus. What they're prohibiting is off-campus jobs, which would give students a foothold outside the university, a way of monitoring how their thoughts are being affected.
We have a student.
And as you say, it would tend to discriminate against working class students who maybe would want to attend school part-time.
We have an activist student on the line. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Jim Boyle. I'm a graduate student in the Department of English and Comparative Literature. And I just wanted to, first of all, to Mr. Schmidt, to thank you very much for your book. It's been, it's been really influential and I think timely in my case. So I wanted to thank you for writing it.
Thanks.
First of all, my question really is, I I actually have backgrounds in my undergraduate experience in physics and literature, so I know a little bit about the two disciplines, but I'm doing graduate work in English and comparative literature, the humanities. And yet I find just about everything that you covered in your book, with, you know, some slight exceptions, could be applied very easily to the humanities at this moment. And I think the main difference for me is that the sciences still have the real support of outer corporations in a very direct way. So you can kind of see the lines between kind of ideological conscription, if you will, and the funding coming from outside in, corporations. In the humanities, that link is not there, to put it frankly. And yet, the same sorts of kinds of, again, conscription, silencing, isolation, elimination of anything other than, you know, derivative voices is there. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, maybe, it's a difficult question, I realize it may be slightly outside your expertise, but the lack of any type of real public intellectualism in the humanities, and some of these structures being present in the humanities that you've outlined for the sciences. I mean, do you see a link there, or could you talk a little bit about maybe the connection where that's concerned?
It seems to me that some of the problems could be even worse outside of the sciences. One thing about the sciences, as you say, is that they're well-funded. In other words, there's a lot of money coming in from the corporations and from government research agencies and so on. And there are a lot of high-paying jobs available to graduate scientists. However, jobs are a real issue for people in the humanities, isn't that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So this could cause even increased competition in the humanities. And so you're going to have less of a cooperative spirit. There could be less tolerance for nonconformist ideas. The competition to conform can be even greater.
Well, there is also another factor. Basically, there is a dramatic shift in the openings. Basically, all the openings are in science, while the humanities have most of the time lecturer or a non-tenure position. So where the money is present, then they open position that are tenured, but people that are in the humanities are actually paid by the scientists these days.
Could you say a little bit more about that, Stefan?
Well, the question is, as you know, there is a lot of money coming from science, right, from science department, because either through partnership with corporation or directed by NIH or other federal agency, people can apply for pretty good grants and get more money. Humanities usually don't have that luxury.
Okay.
So there is a lot of, I actually talked with an old professor here at UCI, very, very, very good person, and we were chatting about, you know, the dramatic shift that there is these days, there are these days, in terms of offering way more positions in science departments compared to humanity departments, because of course the science department can generate profit, while the humanities are sort of a luxury. So instead of having someone that is tenure, you have a platoon of lecturers that you can fire any moment, and that's it.
And exploitable graduate student labor at the lower
tiers.
Exactly. Thank you very much for taking my call, and thank you for the book.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Thank you. You also have a chapter, Jeff, in your book, Disciplined Minds, about narrowing the political perspective, or narrowing the political spectrum. What did you mean by that?
Well, kind of an analogy. When I was living in New York City, I would observe people going to work in the morning on the subway, and I would joke to visitors, people visiting me from out of town, I would say, no two people on the train are allowed to read the same thing. And they would look around, and, you know, everybody was reading something different. There was somebody reading a, you know, computer software instruction, somebody else reading a magazine, a novel, the Post, the New York Times. whatever, and there's usually somebody there reading the Bible. One day I took a commuter train from Westchester County, where Hillary Clinton lives, took that into the city in the morning. And that train was filled with managers and professionals, and everybody was reading the same thing. Everybody was either reading the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. They were all absorbing the same information. So this is what I meant by narrowing the political spectrum. When you take this diverse group of thinkers and put them through professional training, the dropping out and the kicking out process, not being politically neutral, results in a much more homogeneous group ideologically.
Oh, we have another caller on the phone. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Catherine calling from Huntington Beach. Hi, everyone. I actually have a question for Jeff, actually. Throughout the discussion, I heard you talk about how scientists, grad students, and professionals, especially in science, are generally conservative, are quite isolated from the world, and tend to take on studies and research that produce capital. Could you talk about the social and environmental implications of this? And maybe also, what would you recommend to the majority of the community who is usually scientifically quite inept and put a lot of trust over into science and scientists who are making decisions on our world?
Well, I find it astounding that there is no radical group of scientists in the United States, scientists or technologists or engineers, even though science plays a huge role in the economy. The direction of science is left completely to the corporations and politicians.
What happened to Science for the People?
Well, Science for the People was one of the longest lasting organizations that came out of the 1960s, but it didn't last forever. It lasted for maybe 20 years or so.
And the British had a similar group, Science for People, right?
Yeah.
But isn't that part of this other big myth about, you know, the concept of like trust, we are the experts. So basically, because I have a PhD, then I know way more than you. Well, always in that scheme of hierarchy, I have a PhD and therefore I know way more than you. Don't question me.
Exactly, that's the attitude. But the public is catching on to that, because the public sees disputes like court cases where both sides have their PhDs and the two PhDs give contradictory statements. So the public starts to think, maybe there's a political component to this.
And Stefano, you have an MD also.
Yes, I'm super active. Don't question me at all.
I'm scared of you, Stefano.
But you mentioned very interesting that comparison between theoretical and experimental physicists, and how the experimental physicists have this regard, because actually they're sort of technicians. Basically, they apply theories that they didn't generate.
In the book, I have a chapter that explores the hierarchy of status between experimenters and theorists, and I ask the question, why are theorists more respected within the field than experimenters, even though experimenters outnumber theorists 2-1 in physics? And I discovered that there is no reason in physics itself, because the experimental work requires just as much creativity as the theoretical work. And I trace that hierarchy of status to the overall division of labor in society, where ultimately capital dominates labor. And therefore anything that's more like what the capitalist does has a higher status, and that the status of the experimenter's work is undermined by the ability to liken it to manual labor.
You know, one thing about another case that was more very visible recently was very prominent, was the Wenho Li spy case, and he worked at Los Alamos. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how the people that were anti-racial profiling of him their kind of perspective was pretty narrow. They didn't challenge the state. They didn't, in the sense of challenging what work he did. They just wanted him to be able to work and continue to work at this bomb making, lab. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, that's an interesting point, isn't it? You're saying that what you're saying is right. You're saying that the people who supported him were not at all critical of the overall mission of the laboratory or his role in it.
Because I was at the D2K protest, and the Wen Houli supporters were there from various Chinese communities in LA, and they shouted down a Asian Left Forum speaker, calling her a communist for speaking there, because she was radical.
Right. Well, the liberal capitalists are trying to build a system without racial profiling. In other words, they want to get all races and genders to serve their interests equally, and so they have no use for the communists. That's for sure.
But the racial profiling still goes on though. So even if they profess they don't want racial profiling, that's what all these people that work in the lab say, that they can't. There's a glass ceiling there. The Chinese can't go above certain levels.
Of course. Yeah, there's a lot of racial profiling.
This is actually a general question. Do you think that this anti-global movement can have an impact on the education system? You see some progress in that regard? You know, this young generation getting a little bit more aware of what's going on.
Well, it has already had an impact just in terms of the people involved themselves. When anybody gets involved in trying to change the world in any way, then the system has to expose its true nature to those people, because in its attempt to stop them, its attempt to stop the change, they end up revealing what they're all about. So the people involved there have gotten a tremendous education. And I was part of the protest in Washington, D.C., and there was a tremendous amount of expertise right out there on the street. The protesters knew a tremendous amount about world economics and everything else. They had learned all of this on their own.
Right. What was it like in the 70s here then? I mean, politically in Orange County?
It was pretty conservative.
It
still is, I'm sure, yeah. And there was...
But how many people were...
The racial profiling, I know, certainly going on then. I remember going out to eat once with Sam Ma, one of my fellow physics graduate students, an Asian American, and this little shop we went to eat at had a sign up there. It said, 3 seconds on the soup. So Sam asked... at poor graduate students, he asked, 3 seconds, does that mean you can have as much soup as you want, or just one more serving? I don't remember what the answer was, but we ate our dinner there and left. And as we were leaving, the police showed up. The owners of the shop had called the police, fearing that this was the beginning of an attempt to rob their business. So Sam in particular, had to undergo interrogation by the police.
This is Irvine police or what?
I think it was in the Costa Mesa area. I'm not sure which police force it was.
Yeah. But in terms of the Science for Peace people, how many people were involved, and how did you start the group, or what happened there?
The group had a lot of people involved. We were pretty much based in the physics department, because that's where most of our people were, but we had people from other departments as well, and we sponsored a lot of events. Some of them had a couple hundred people show up to them. And
so there's actually politically active physics graduate students at UCI. Mm-hmm.
Yes, Right. There were a few of us.
Did you have a newsletter, or how did that? How do you communicate among yourselves?
Just through our meetings. We didn't have a newsletter.
No email.
No email either. Yeah.
Did you find, Jeff, that people wanted to be politically active but didn't really know how, and they tried to hold themselves back, possibly they didn't want to stir anything up within the department and they didn't know how to go about it?
Ignorance of how to do it, it was never a problem. It's only a question of the will to do it.
Right.
I mean, certainly fear dominated, so that maybe people were afraid to do it.
Right. In general, you find in physics that scientists in general aren't that politically aware or socially concerned, true?
That's true,
right.
But they share that trait in common with other professions.
True.
But in graduate school especially, don't you think the sciences are much more, the graduate students in the sciences are much more dependent on their professors rather than in the humanities maybe, because in a way it's, because you have to bring in, you know, you have to work on their projects, and then you don't even get listed in the articles, or you get, you know, the fifth author or whatever, even though you did all the work.
Right. I don't know how much, I don't know if there are more dependents in the sciences. It may vary from department to department or professor to professor.
But because of the labs maybe, huh? I mean, that you can't cross your professor, your mentor.
Right.
So
this would be true outside of the sciences also.
That's true. So what's the solution? I mean, you suggested getting out of campus jobs or to be not so dependent. What are other solutions?
Well, the off-campus job is not necessarily a solution. The primary solution is finding some like-minded people, some people who have the guts to try to change things. The solution is organizing in one way or another.
Did you find, Jeff, when you were here, that there were any faculty members in the sciences that did have some sort of political awareness or some kind of political interest in being active? Or could you say they were all pretty much conservative?
They were pretty conservative. There were some.
There was no one. There was no faculty that supported your.
None of them were outspoken. Some of them who would want to speak out were afraid to because of the atmosphere created by the others.
Mm-hmm.
However, we started our group just as a weekly seminar, which any students could do in any department. We just held a weekly lunchtime seminar, and we started.
What sorts of things did you speak about?
Yeah, you can invite anybody from any department. Like, we could bring over a historian from the history department to talk about some subject we were interested in, and then the physics graduate students started attending that on a regular basis, and pretty soon, you're talking about issues within the department and larger issues, and this can lead to an organization.
Well, things are moving, actually, even now. There is a group that is called Academia in Action, and I'm a member of it. And it's actually pretty good. We did quite a bit last year, and we really want to do something more this year. We just finished, actually, together with another group, ACT for... What is
ACT for... actually, Jen, who just was on the phone, she was very active in the tent city. We had a... sleeping.
Right, exactly. That group
in Aldrich Park, where people were raising the issue of refugees in Afghanistan, and one night they had even a hip hop congress, which is a student group, come and sing political hip hop, chant and rap until midnight. This was Tuesday night, actually.
Great.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, we had actually pretty incredible. We had a very good media coverage. We got even the CNN coming down to see what was going on, and all the...
Yeah, and ABC even broadcast live from the hip-hop thing that night for the 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock news.
Right.
One key point, actually, that really struck me is this concept of creativity. You know, basically you are in a school in which you enter just to increase your ability to do creative work and explore any possible angle of science, perhaps, or any humanities sector. And yet, most of the time, particularly in science, you are forced to very strong way to conform. You basically, when you choose your mentor, you are forced to basically follow what the mentor was doing. There are very rare cases, I know for sure, that in which actually a graduate student can do some real creative work, which is out of the lines of the main hypothesis or line of work of the mentor. That's an incredible paradox to me.
It may seem like a paradox, but when you think about it a little bit, what you end up realizing is that professionals do creative work, but they aren't necessarily independent thinkers.
Right, exactly.
So creative work and independent thinking are two different things. People in the advertising industry, for example,
right.
Creative work is their business, but their employers tell them what product they're going to promote, how they're going to promote it. I mean, they might say, turn your creativity to getting 25-year-old women to smoke our cigarettes.
Right. I think that this is actually a very American problem, maybe because the education at the high school level is so poor. Basically, you have people that are hyper-specialized, so they know exactly everything, every single aspect in their very narrow field, and then they are really, idiots. If you ask about anything else, they don't know even where they live. Basically, they don't have any notion of geography or history. They don't know anything. And quite true, because I'm not, as you understand, I'm not from the United States, and I can definitely tell you that there is an incredible difference in the overall cultural background between a person that has a PhD in France and someone that has it in the United States. It's incredible the level of basic knowledge that the Europeans or other Asians as well have compared to the Americans that I really don't know, which I think is actually very instrumental to keep people in sort of a bliss situation. They don't really know what's going on. They know exactly, they're perfect technicians, they do what they're told to do, but they don't really understand what is the big picture. And I think you mentioned this situation in the book.
Yes, the first way I mentioned it in the book is in terms of this thing of the trains going into New York City, because what I noticed in comparing the subway riders and the suburban train riders is that the people who showed the greatest diversity in their dress, their behavior, and their thought, the non-professionals, these people would be asked to do the least creative work when they arrived at the workplace, while the most regimented people would be assigned the creative tasks. This seems like the opposite of what one might expect. But the answer is that people who do creative work are not necessarily independent thinkers. So the key thing for us is to encourage people to be independent thinkers.
At that time, was there also this dependence on government? You mentioned some of that, but was there actually, now there's a concern that, biotech companies are dictating research on campus, they're buying up office space on, next to UCI, so that the professors can be on their board, and they can give $1 million to a, lab, so that graduate students can work there for peanuts, while the corporation says you can't release the, data until 3 years after we sell it, as a trademark thing. And so basically we're kind of, the university becomes a servant of industry. Was that a big thing then too, or is it?
It was, but it was less formal. You still at that, decades ago, you had professors bragging, they'd say, well, I'm a consultant for IBM.
Yeah.
They would brag about that, whereas now they can actually have an IBM unit right on campus.
Right, it could be the IBM chair or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Do you see any similarity between your work and the work of Ivan Illich in his radical critique of the education system among other institutions.
Yes, I find his de-schooling concept very, very good. The thing to realize is that schooling does not make people more liberal, more critical, more radical, more independent in their thinking. On the other hand, lack of schooling doesn't make people more radical either.
But you know, I know a lot of anarchists who are dropping out of high school,
mm-hmm.
and they're saying, you know, the school system, you know, is horrible. We don't want to subject ourselves to it, and they go on the web and get stuff. Do you think that's one way? And maybe read radical pamphlets on the web, on some anarchist websites and stuff like that.
I think it's great that they are anarchists. I would rather have them stay in the school and struggle there.
Right. A few weeks ago, I interviewed a lawyer for a 15-year-old girl who started an anarchy club, and she was suspended. She had an anti-war T-shirt also,
mm-hmm.
against the Afghanistan war, and she's been suspended. So now, you know, it's kind of stalemate at this point.
Well, you see, there's a lesson right there. The fact that they suspended an anarchist indicates that they want the anarchists out of the school. So the anarchists should stay in the schools and try to change things.
Well, she's being homeschooled now, right?
Actually, right.
Yeah. But what turned you into a radical then?
I had been involved in, even before I came to UCI, I was involved in the movement against the war in Vietnam as an undergraduate at UCLA.
And did you, at that time, how many people really were active in this kind of progressive causes at UCI at the time, you think, among the graduate students, for instance?
During the Vietnam War?
Oh, no, during the time you were at Irvine.
A tiny fraction.
Was it like 100 people, 50 people? How many would you estimate?
Graduate students on campus?
Yeah.
Four.
30. 30.
That's
yeah.
Good.
And these were across departments, not just in the sciences, right?
Right.
Going back to your issue about professional and non-professional, I'm actually really curious about how do you see this new force, which is, you know, with this, the mantra now is flexibility, and we see more and more people that actually, under this new economy, the so-called new economy, are actually temporary workers. So how do you see this new category fitting in either in the professional or non-professional working force?
Well, flexibility is the political, ideological flexibility is the key to understanding professionals. In other words, the professional has to be prepared to go to bat for the particular employer. And when they change employers, they have to be ready to change sides. And in the book, I give examples of people, for example, who were journalists, all of a sudden becoming government
right.
spokespeople.
Exactly.
So they change sides. And when the government hires an adversary like that, and the next, you know, one day he's on one side of the podium, the next day he's on the next, the government doesn't worry about whether he's going to reveal more information than the government wants or something like that, or they State Department spokesman or whatever, because the person is a professional, meaning that they've been tested in terms of the ability to take an assigned ideology.
So what are you?
I'm reminded of that by the pictures in the newspaper of the Taliban people who turn up the next day as Northern Alliance leaders and vice versa.
Actually, we're coming to close about time. What's your webpage?
Disciplined-minds.com.
And they can get information about the book there?
Yes, information about the book and about my dismissal from Physics Today over
right.
the book and the protest against my dismissal.
So are you pursuing a lawsuit?
No, I'm counting on public pressure, and there's a lot of it.
You got a lot of response, right? You told me about 700 signatures from academics and non-academics.
That's right. Over 750 people have sent letters or signed group letters protesting my dismissal.
Well, I have to tell you, actually, that your book is unbelievable. It's very popular in Italy, probably in Europe. It got into mailing list and became really, really, really popular. So actually, we have to work on a translation in Italian.
Great.
You are a celebrity in Europe.
Well, on that note, I guess our time is up. Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Stefano.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Goodbye. We'll keep in touch. Bye.
Bye.
That was Jeffrey Schmidt, author of Dissident Minds from Roman and Littlefield in Lanham, Maryland. Dissident Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives. This is Dan Zhang signing off for Subversity here on KCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The opinions expressed on the show were not necessarily those of the Regents of the University of California, nor the management of KUCI. Coming up, Schwab Transmission. This is KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.